You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. On May 27th, CBS launched a new reality show from the creator of The Biggest Loser. It's called The Briefcase. Here's a clip from the show's trailer.
Across America, hardworking families are feeling the impact of rising debts and shrinking paychecks. These tough times are testing the human spirit.
Both of you were given a briefcase with $100,000 cash and have been deciding on whether to share any money with each other.
Faced with the decision to lift your family out of financial hardship or to hold a helping hand to another family in need, what would you do?
Two families, both struggling financially, must decide whether to keep, share, or give all of the money in the briefcase to the other family, without knowing that both families have been presented with the same choice. On its debut night, The Briefcase had more than 6 million viewers.
To discuss the show and what it says about how Americans perceive those who are struggling financially, we're joined by show creator and executive producer David Broom. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for the time.
So what was your motivation behind creating the show?
Well, I make shows that have some depth, and I like doing things that have a transformational aspect to them. You know, the kind of shows that I like to make have some type of a socially redeemable quality and make you think. You know, I like doing things that have a thought provocativeness to them. So I've always wanted to do a show that talks about what matters most in your life. You know, and so I used a lottery ticket as kind of the analogy, as a jumping off point, because we've all had that dream of scratching a lottery ticket one day and going, oh my gosh, look how much money I just won. Well, now what if that lottery ticket came with an opportunity to kind of evaluate your lives? What would that do, and what kind of conversations would you have? So that was the starting point for the show.
Now, one criticism that the show has received is that it asks the viewing audience, as well as the families who are the participants in the show, to make a value judgment about who is more or less deserving of help. And one example that has been cited is that the families in each episode are taken to each other's homes to actually look through their bills to see how they spend their money each month. What's the intended purpose of that component of the show?
Yeah, I don't think the families are asked to make a value judgment. I think that there's a lot of interesting debate and chatter on this show. You know, the show has been characterized as pitting two poor families against each other. And that's, first of all, that's wrong, and from lots of levels, and it's wrong in the spirit of the show. These families who have come on to the show are middle-class families by design. And they feel, every single one of them that has been a participant, feels like they've received a blessing. So it's not whose values are higher than someone else's values. They're operating in their own vacuum. They're questioning themselves. They're evaluating themselves. This isn't man versus man. This is them looking at their own lives. And when you know, empathy is something that's really interesting. When you have the opportunity to learn about somebody else and walk a day in their shoes, it gives you the opportunity to reflect back on your life. It's not your values at that point. All of the focus groups, that's the highest rated part of the entire episodes. They love that because you get a chance to see how your neighbor basically lives. And that's what we want to do with the show, because that's what starts the conversations in your house. All of a sudden, it's not a conversation about money anymore. It's a conversation about life.
So,
and that's the show.
Just to push back on that a little bit,
push back hard. don't push back a little.
All right, then I'm gonna push all the way back.
You should come after my jugular.
All right, then we'll see what happens. But
okay.
You know, I appreciate what you're saying. I think, you know, at Talk Poverty Radio, we do try to lift up the experiences and voices of people who are struggling, and so we see a value in that. But what this scene is actually doing, as your show, even in the beginning, it says that it's two deserving middle-class families, so it does use that language, but they really are looking at how much of a struggle they're faced. You know, they say, oh, look at these, this washer and dryer is broken. And that's the kind of policies that we see conservatives pushing, that you have to somehow determine if someone's poor enough. So that's why people do feel uncomfortable with it and are making that criticism. So, you know, why have that scene when there is an assessment?
Why should we have someone assess somebody else's
instead of, you know, talking maybe face to face with the family?
Well, because when you're face to face with somebody, you might not be as real and raw as you're going to be before you're face-to-face with somebody. In order to be able to really kind of dig down deep into who you are, what you want, what your feelings may be, I mean, just think about it. You know, you meet somebody for the first time. Do you really tell them how you feel? Or do you have that up? You don't, because that's not what we do. We're very polite.
I typically listen. When I first meet people.
but I want to just start off, because especially with you guys, because talkpoverty.org it's an important, I'm wanting to do this with you guys, because I think there's a really important and valuable message that your organization stands for. I want to just take one step back, and then we can go forward. The show is designed around middle class families. The criticism that the show has been given by many, not the fans, by the way, the fans who've watched the show, overwhelmingly, more than 80%, think it's one of the best and most inspirational shows on television. But the media has given it a very, very tough slant. And one of the things that we're up against in the headlines is two poor or poverty-stricken families are pitted against each other. You've seen those headlines, haven't you?
Yeah, we have.
Okay. So I would like to ask you guys, because you're more of the expert than I am, because I'm not tending to be a spokesperson for the middle class or the poor, but what is the definition of poverty in this country?
So I'm actually really glad that you brought that up, because part of what we wanted to talk with you about was the fact that the show really does go out of its way to emphasize that these families are middle class. And so something that we actually strive to do on Talk Poverty Radio is to highlight the fact that poverty is not a lifelong identity, but is rather a lived experience. And it's actually an experience that most Americans will encounter at some point in their lives. So it might shock you to hear, and I think it's probably at some point shocked many of our listeners to hear, that half of all Americans will experience poverty or near poverty, so living very close to the poverty line, for at least a year at some point during their working years.
No, it doesn't shock me. And I think there's a big difference, too, between absolute poverty, right? Because I think if you kind of get into the technical definitions, there's something that's an absolute poverty that is defined by, by our government, right? A family of four that earns less than $24,000 a year in the technical sense is considered a family that's poverty stricken. Is that correct?
That's the official poverty measure,
right,
that our federal government uses, which I should say is considered by most who study poverty to be actually inadequate to measure financial hardship, which is what the families in your show are experiencing.
Right. The families in my show are your typical middle class families. And let's just talk about that, what that really means. That means that in an episode like you just watched in our second episode, Josh and Susan Scott, our little people family, earn about $73,000 a year. There's two of them. Now, first, are they poor or poverty? No, they're not. They're not there by any definition of the word or any definition of what poverty is. Are they struggling? Yes, they are. They live paycheck to paycheck, because that's what's gone on in our country. And the reason why I wanted to take families that are your middle class families in this country is because they and not your poor and not your wealthy. The fact of the matter is that if you're only thinking that the show is first and foremost about money, well, that's one conversation.
But
if you're thinking that the show might be more than just about money, then it's a whole entirely different
Let
area.
Me just jump in to go back to something that you just said, though. So you said that the family is not, by any definition of the words, experiencing poverty. So
right.
I think the thing that we that neither you nor we would disagree about, though, is that they are facing significant financial straits, dire financial straits, and the families.
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say they're dire. I think and we're probably on the same page, because most people, and I don't even think it's middle class. I think most people in this country, even people in Hollywood that would give the image of well off, I think are a couple of really unfortunate and potentially tragic situations from being in a massively downward spiral.
So since you brought that up, right, I think something that Tracy and I have both really thought a lot about while watching the episodes of the show that have aired thus far is that, as you just pointed out, a lot of the challenges that are showcased in the show that the families are facing are really, unfortunately, fairly common, right? So the deep debt, not being able to pay their bills, not having health insurance, not having maternity leave. But there are actual policy solutions to address these challenges, and that isn't something that is showcased in the show.
You can't go there. You know, you're on a network primetime television series. We're not there to talk about policies or government policies. That's not what the show is.
But since your intention, as you said, is to elevate these issues, and that is a lot of what you're trying to do with the show.
No, one second. Let me just outline what my intention is. A, because I'm at the end of the day, I can't change the world. I'm a television producer, and so what I first and foremost is I want to entertain an audience. Secondly, I want to entertain them not with junk, not with crap, not with trash, not with the stuff that you typically see many times in unscripted television, but I want to entertain them with very thought-provocative conversations that are taking place in households and dealing with issues that you don't get a chance to talk about.
But unfortunately, it is in this framing of, you know, it's not about money. It's about the journey. People are seeing that this values discussion
that
you're trying to have.
Well, I don't want to say that it's not about money. That would be false. There is a money aspect to the show. But I think what's important is it's not about just money, and it's about so much more than money.
Well, could I make a suggestion, actually?
Sure.
Because so I, in watching one of the episodes, you know, a woman was talking about how she didn't have access to paid maternity leave. And, you know, if you're watching the show, it might seem like, well, this woman has some bad luck. If at the end of the show there was a title card that said 11%, only 11% of people have access to paid maternity leave in the private sector, that would be amazing. It seems like there is an opportunity, but instead, because you fall short of talking about the fact that these are real policies impacting people, there's a reinforcement that there is no role for maybe government intervention. There is no role for service providers.
I think that's a good point. You know, I would love to do those kinds of things. You know, I believe me, you know, I would love to do that. I created The Biggest Loser. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the weight loss show on NBC. I still executive produce it. And by the way, I've gotten slammed for the same thing that The Biggest Loser did and does that I am on The Briefcase. Oh, you're bringing those overweight fat people onto television. Oh, you're exploiting them by making them take off their shirts. So you could say whatever you want, but at the end of the day, the show has, and they have themselves, changed their lives, saved their lives, inspired others. And would I love to have that series end with the kinds of information that you're saying? Well, yeah, I would. I'm given 42 minutes of television time.
Yeah, I mentioned social media. You could direct people to CBS's website and have resources for on how people can push their policymakers.
I think those are excellent suggestions. I really do.
Dave, it's great to hear you say that. I mean, I know you've been doing a lot of tweeting about the show. If we were to provide you with some resources, would you be willing to tweet them out to your viewers?
Yeah, let me see. Of course I would. Listen, I've gone online. This one guy says, CBS, take The Briefcase off the air immediately. I said, okay.
And he's not alone. That's a criticism you've heard from a lot of people.
And so I reached out to him. hey, thanks for your post, saw it. I'm the executive producer and the creator. Love to hear. Why do you feel that way? You are. Oh, let me get it exactly right. You're exploiting poor, poverty people. And I said to him, "Have you seen the episodes?" And his response was, "Not yet."
As someone who has seen, you know, both episodes so far, you know, I've been curious as to isn't there another way you could have structured this without, bringing the families on under false pretenses. You know, they didn't know there was going to be this whole briefcase challenge. You know, why put them through
there's no challenge. It's not a competition or contest, right? They believe that they were part of a documentary.
Exactly. So they're brought under false pretenses.
Let's go through it together. Families think that they're part of a documentary that's following their money, their finances. We tell them, the money's yours. Here it is. You can do anything you want with it, but there's a decision. We want you to talk about this, this, and this. Every single family turned to us immediately and said, this is an amazing opportunity, and we're going to take this decision seriously. I'm sorry, I'm going to let you answer one thing. Can you imagine the joy they got in being able to not only potentially use this money for themselves, but actually give anything to somebody else? And in the first episodes that you watched, both families unknowingly shared $100,000 with each other. Tell me why you watched an episode where two families who both needed money ultimately ended up giving without knowing, but they gave their full $100,000 away.
So
why?
So this actually gets us into another question that I had for you, which is...
No, wait a minute. You got to answer my
question. I am. I'm going to answer it, and it comes with a question as well.
Go ahead.
Which is... Isn't it relevant that there are television cameras on them the entire time?
And that
they are faced not with a private decision, but with a very, very public decision with 6 million viewers watching? Isn't the show set up in such a way where there's really only one, quote, right choice? And that if they don't give the money to the other family, they appear selfish?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the answer is not really. A little bit of what you're saying is accurate at the beginning. But you know, there's two things happen. First of all, people are who they are, if the camera's there or not. And the truth is, what you're saying is probably right for just a little amount of time. But the cameras seem to disappear in people's lives. If you look at those conversations and listen to the conversations that our families are having with each other, can you imagine the rawness and the realness? But that's what tends to happen.
But the interesting thing about the raw, real emotions is that it was manipulated. Because
how's that? How do you think they were manipulated?
Well, because they don't know that the other family is making the same decision.
That doesn't matter. Let's talk about that.
It doesn't? Why doesn't it matter?
No, it doesn't. Because in fact, you couldn't be more wrong. You want them to operate in a vacuum. If they knew the other family was given a briefcase, then you're not getting their raw, real emotions. You want to talk about money in the first episode? Joe Bergen and Kim, he hasn't made a financial decision in 20 years of marriage. He burdened his wife with every single financial decision in their house. And at the end of this experience, what does he do? He says, this experience changed my life, and it changed my marriage.
And in the process, she gets physically ill and actually throws up outside of the car because
she's
so emotionally fraught by the turmoil of the decision.
You're right. Guess what? Buckle yourself in. You're going to watch the most real and raw thing you've seen on television. And when she vomits on the side of the road and comes to the conclusion that we have so much in our life. We may not have so much money, but we have so much love. That's what brings her to that conclusion. If this experience opened their eyes to dealing with finances differently in their household, which, by the way, is something I think your organization wants to teach people to do,
how they can deal
with finances better, right?
I think actually we would argue that dire financial straits are largely the result of an economy that really isn't working for everyone as opposed to poor financial decisions.
That's not what happened in this case. In this case, I think in a lot of these cases, you would see that it's not just one reason. you know, Joe Bergen lost his corporate job in corporate America that 10 years ago. That kind of started a spiral.
He then, Rebecca was alluding to.
Right. That's one economic situation that caused it. But then he had a series of very bad luck things happen. He had car accidents with an ice cream truck business that his wife convinced him to get into. They had three trucks. Two of them went away. They couldn't function.
But that's the thing is that our economy is not designed to let people have bad luck. You know, have to have a life that's just charmed in order to survive.
I think you're right by that. That's why I totally agree with that. That's why everybody is on the brink of a potential downward spiral, because it just takes a couple of incidents to do that. I don't disagree with that at all. I think you're absolutely right. But if you can come out of this experience with a conclusion, my marriage is better off now. We're communicating with each other in ways that we never communicated before. That lesson is invaluable.
Dave, I have one last question for you. You've been...
That's it, we're done?
Well, we'd be happy to keep you on for the whole hour, but you've been a great guest, and we appreciate you taking all these questions. I have one last question for you. The show, in its opening, says very clearly that two families, two, quote, deserving middle-class families, are the participants of the show. Do you believe that there are some people who are more or less deserving of help?
No, I don't know. It's not that. I just think that the word deserving is, you know, what I learned in making the show is that these families are making sacrifices every single day in their life. Whether or not, you know, that's what the middle class is doing. They do it to help a friend. They do it to help a neighbor. They do it to help their children. They do it to help a stranger. And so, to me, it's not that these families are any more deserving than other families. And it's just we're saying too deserving. And I think that anybody who makes a sacrifice is that. And by the way, I wrote an op-ed piece that this making this series has affected me so much. I consider myself a good person. I try to do the right things. I'm honest. I'm hardworking. I like to think of myself as a good guy. But when I went away and I made this series, I had to question my life, because no matter what good I've ever done, and I have done a lot of good things. I mean, I made a tsunami special, one of the proudest moments in my career, with George Clooney for NBC. 10 days after the tsunami tragedy hit, we raised $21 million through the Red Cross. It was a very emotional moment. But you know what? With everything that I've done that's good in my life, nobody would look at me and go, hey, this is somebody who gives me a renewed faith in humanity, because I've never really done anything that has come at a sacrifice. And to me, that's what you find in the spirit of this country. That's what you find in the spirit of the show. These families are making sacrifices every day, and that's what's meant by saying deserving.
Our guest is David Broom, producer of the new CBS show, The Briefcase. Thanks for joining us, and we're going to definitely follow up with you with some of those resources we said you could share during the show.
Send them to me, please.
We really appreciate you coming on the show, and thanks again, Dave Broom.
Thanks for the time.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And with me of WEACT Radio fame is the one, the only, Alex Lawson. How are you, Alex?
Wonderful. How are you?
I am just peachy. It's been a little crazy over here. We've had quite the episode so far.
Yeah, I heard about it. Sounds extremely... I don't know what it is, but I'm happy that you got that interview.
It is something. It is something that it is hard to put one's finger on. But we wanted to have you on the show today to talk a little bit about waste, fraud, and abuse. How does that sound?
That sounds great. Great topic.
So waste, fraud, and abuse is on my mind lately because I was busy cramming for a hearing that the House Ways and Means Committee held on waste, fraud, and abuse. Three words that always go together. But you're interested in this subject too, just generally. Why?
Mainly it is the number one red herring that is used in this town. it is trotted out to do any time that the right wants to do things like that are basically punching poorer Americans in the face with policy. They trot out, you know, some waste, fraud, and abuse. They don't want to actually do anything. What they want to do is throw red meat to their base. And that is almost always. I actually would say always, because I've never seen it not be that. And the hearing that you testified at was just, you know, yet another. They're basically sitting there setting up some sound bites that they can show back home to show how they are taking on, you know, the frame of the takers, the people who are just the, you know, not actually. I'm fumbling here because I'm looking for, what did Mitt Romney call him?
The 47%.
The 47%, right.
Well, and I should be clear that this hearing that I testified at was not waste, fraud, and abuse generally, right? It was, quote, protecting the safety net from waste, fraud, and abuse. And so very clearly, the individuals convening the hearing, who need not be named because I've already named them, are much more concerned with the perception of waste, fraud, and abuse when it comes to low-income people who our government is spending exceptionally small percentages of the federal budget on than they are in, say, I don't know, defense.
Exactly. But that's the problem I have with it, is that waste, fraud, and abuse in that construction is never actually about anything meaningful. It's not about the, say, waste, fraud, and abuse that the Beltway bandits, the defense contractors, you know, the F-35 boondoggle, trillions of dollars, trillions with a T, on a weapon system that the military does not want, and it has never worked. And when it was being formulated, it was to fight the Soviet Union, which does not exist anymore. Right?
I mean, details, like, details.
That is actually, if someone were actually talking about things like that, or the billions of dollars in cash, pallets of cash that went missing, they just lost it. How do you lose billions of dollars in Iraq, in the Iraq war? You know, that is something that could be useful, but that's never what they're talking about, right? They're talking about, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse to protect the safety net. What that means is, let's make people's lives just a bit harder because it'll help them get elected.
So one example of the way that this waste, fraud, and abuse talk ends up kind of coming up and becoming a talking point is one that you and I were talking about off air. It often comes up in the Social Security context, which you and I both care a lot about. And most recently, this past week, it has made all sorts of headlines. So our listeners may have seen just hugely dramatic headlines like Social Security overpaid half of its disability beneficiaries, right? Which those were quite literally the headlines I saw in every major media outlet that picked the story up.
Right.
Which, and it ran the gamut. It wasn't just Fox News, who, you know, was one of the first, but it was, you know, all the way out to The Hill, right, and other news outlets and the Associated Press, I should say, which broke the story. But when you actually dig beneath the headlines and look at what what Social Security's watchdog found that spurred this, oh my God, half of beneficiaries nonsense, is Social Security actually overpaid 1%, right? Half is a nice headline. Much more dramatic than 1% of the benefits that Social Security paid out over the last decade was an overpayment.
Right.
Right. A little different.
Or 99% correct payments.
Right.
Right?
Like, not a good headline.
That headline, it exactly. It's really annoying that the media does not actually know how to tell that story. It's despicable that this is actually what it was set up for, right? I mean, like, this is a media strategy. When I'm saying red meat to throw to their base, the folks on the Hill who want to do this, they're not interested in fixing anything. In fact, they like breaking things and then complaining about them not working.
Well, and that's the other piece of the story that media should be telling, but they miss, right? So they love half of beneficiaries were overpaid as their headline, but then they don't ask the questions of, okay, A, really, let's put that in perspective. It's really 1% of benefit payments, but also B, what led up to the fact that any overpayments even happened? And if they were to ask that question, they would find that congressional appropriators have been depriving the Social Security Administration, much less all the other agencies, of anything approaching the level of administrative resources that they need to friggin' administer their programs and to root out improper payments.
Right. Except we know that they don't care about the agency, that in fact, this is all part and parcel of one strategy that has been stated. And you can go back and read it and say, oh, okay, this is what they're doing. This is part of the starve the beast strategy. A large component of that, you kneecap the mailman, and then you complain that the mail is late, right? So you break the program. You put in laws and you don't fund it to the point where it's not going to work. And then you turn around and you use that to say, you know, we have to get rid of the U.S. Postal Service because it can't deliver mail. It can't da-da-da-da-da.
Or in this case, we have to clean up those Social Security disability programs because look at all that waste, fraud, and abuse.
So I would say that the waste, fraud, and abuse hearings are actually more designed to encourage fraud. That's what they want. They want more fraud in the system. They want
pro-fraud hearings.
Yes. They want things to break because that's their overarching goal.
And it's not just a rhetorical problem, right? It isn't just news stories that are themselves a problem. I mean, that actually is, I think, enough of a problem because it does poison political opinion and support for important programs like Social Security's disability programs. But taking it one step farther, what those kinds of news stories pave the way to is proposals, many of which are right now floating around Congress, that are really benefit cuts dressed up as program integrity, measures to supposedly cut waste, fraud, and abuse. And I'll give you two examples that came up at this hearing last week. One of them, it targets kids with significant disabilities and severe illnesses who receive SSI, Supplemental Security Income Benefits. And what it does is it proposes, tell me what you think and whether this passes your cruel and stupid test. It proposes that kids who receive SSI who are 16 or 17 years old, they should be cut off of the SSI program and lose this hugely important source of income support to their family if they miss school. Yes. That is what this bill proposes.
Both cruel and stupid.
Tell me why.
I mean, first of all, we're talking about a literal lifeline. When you're talking about SSI, you are not talking about a lot of money. You're talking about a tiny amount of money, but the importance of which cannot be overstated. The difference between living with dignity or being institutionalized in many cases. And it's going to end up costing money. That's the stupid part, right? So you pull back SSI, and then other parts of public funding are going to have to take over. In the case of institutionalization, it's extremely obvious. Or, you know, a million other ways. And then it's cruel just on its face that somehow people who are living with severe disabilities need a stick sort of incentive to participate in education is just, I mean, it's un-American in its cruelty, and it's obviously extremely stupid. So ding, 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 cruel and stupid.
A twofer. I would agree. And I would add, it also completely ignores the reality of the population we're talking about. So we've got kids who, for very legitimate health reasons, might miss school, right, or not be able to fully attend school in the same way that other kids do because of the reason that got them the SSI in the first place.
Right.
And the other one, which we don't have time to discuss, that I think, you know, is a great example of benefit cuts dressed up as program integrity, would prevent people with disabilities who are working, who are trying to return to work and get off of disability insurance. It would actually punish them for working. And it would do that by saying, you know what, you, unlike every other worker who pays into the unemployment insurance system, you don't get unemployment insurance when you lose your part-time or full-time job. Sorry, you're not like everyone else. You're disabled. We're going to pick on you.
the definition of a disincentive to work, right?
Yes.
The definition of what economists are always trying to
and
sniff
conservatives.
Out. Exactly. But this is what it's the hypocrisy of big government bully conservatism is like so on its face apparent that, you know, sometimes you don't need to point it out. I like to point it out as much as possible.
It's fun to point out.
But I mean, it is the definition of a disincentive to work. If you take away the unemployment protection, then why? That's just one more reason for somebody not to go. And they, a person who is trying to get back into the workforce through a serious disability, there's a likelihood they're going to lose their job, right? And they probably know that. And then you take away the unemployment insurance. How is that in any way doing anything other than disincentivizing people?
And this
from
particular
work?
Proposal goes even farther because it also puts them at risk of losing their disability benefits too, right? So it's not even just that they don't get UI. It's, hey, by working, you're actually putting your lifeline at risk. So,
all right. Well, Alex Lawson, I'm getting the signal from my producer, Alyssa.
I want to wrap up with one word and give you the final word.
Please.
But here's the this is why me and my business partner started We Act Radio, though. It's because the media is so in cahoots with the folks on the Hill who want to kneecap the mailman and complain that the mail is late, that we need independent voices. And the one thing I disagree with you on is that your show is on the We Act Radio network, which actually means more like you're my boss than the other way around.
Ooh, I like the sound of that. All right, so takeaways for our listeners. 1% does not equal half. And if you can do that math, then you should be a critical thinker when you read stories with headlines like the one we talked about today. And Alex, I look forward to having you back early and often. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And it's time for the Weekly Worst. This is Tracy Ross.
And Rebecca Vallis.
And this is the segment where we have our friend Alan Pike from Think Progress join us. Welcome, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
And Tracy, what do we do for the Weekly-ish Worst?
So Alan brings three horrendous news stories related to poverty, and we vote on which we think is the absolute worst.
Sounds like fun. Alan, what do you have for us this week?
All right. First is a McDonald's owner in Pennsylvania who had been paying employees using these debit cards that charge fees anytime you try to withdraw your wages at an ATM. The owners lost a court decision in early June after a state judge decided that the cards don't count as a legal form of payment under Pennsylvania law. And barring an appeal, the case could eventually trigger penalties as high as about $1.2 million for the couple who owns these McDonald's locations.
So great news from Pennsylvania. The courts are taking out the Weekly Worst.
Yeah. It's surprising that there are so many.
We're all like stunned.
I know. We're like, wait.
Positive action.
Well, there's good news in this segment.
The really surprising thing about this to me was when I called the lawyer for the plaintiffs, he told me that Chase Bank has apparently voluntarily sent refund checks to all of the workers in the class. There's like 2,400 McDonald's workers in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Who just started getting, without any prompting, getting checks back from Chase, reimbursing them for these fees that they'd been paying for three, 4 years.
Surprising. How much were they getting back? Like, how much was a check?
I think he said the smallest was a penny and the largest was like $140.
Oh.
But these cards, I mean, the cards charge you, I think, like $1 for withdrawals or maybe $5 for withdrawals. And it's either $5 for withdrawals and $1 for checking your balance or the other way around, among a bunch of other fees. And this is just to access your wages that earned with your sweat.
Your low wages.
Right.
So taking a bite out of cheeseburgers and wages.
Dun, dun, dun.
That fell really flat. Alan, what do you have for us for number two?
All right. Second is Aurora, Colorado, where a school lunch lady named Della Curry was fired for giving a free lunch to a crying first grader who didn't have any money to buy food. School policy apparently says that students who can't afford lunch should be given a small milk and a slice of American cheese on a hamburger bun. Curry said, quote, "I'll own that I broke the law. The law needs to change."
You couldn't hear my gasp from us.
I heard it. I don't even have words for this one. Shania Twain is not involved in this one, and yet this still might be a new low for the Weekly Worst.
Yeah. I am always surprised at how far people are willing to carry this sort of you got to pay your own way, little Jimmy, the first grader who wants to eat something at school. Like it's nuts. And this is in stark contrast with places like Dallas and Chicago and a number of other cities that have in the last 2 or 3 years instituted free meal policies for all students, regardless of income level. Not just the free lunch and reduced price lunch system that I remember from growing up, but schools that have realized, hey, what if our students actually had, you know, full bellies going into class? Maybe that would actually save us money in the long term.
They call it community eligibility, and it makes a lot of sense, right? Rather than separating out the haves from the have-nots in the lunch line, it's, hey, maybe we should give everybody lunch, and that would just be a lot simpler and also, you know, wouldn't single out the kids who are lower income. So what about number three?
Well, we got more singling out and shaming behavior.
Oh, good.
Great.
Look
at that.
That's
what we're here for.
Three is Detroit, where the water department is once again threatening to shut off water lines at houses where water bills are significantly past due. And my colleague Bryce Covert at Think Progress talked to some Detroit residents who are facing shutoffs about how the department operates. Apparently, they paint your sidewalk blue when they cut your water off, so that everybody who walks by will know
that
you've had your water
shaming.
Cut off. Yeah,
it's not a scarlet A, it's a blue A, but it's on your sidewalk.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just because it's important to the conduct of the water department to have your neighbors think that you're a cheapskate.
And that's also, that sounds like unnecessary labor. They're paying people to go around to paint sidewalks to publicly shame people.
I don't know, Tracy. They're creating jobs.
Oh, that's true.
I've always thought that part of the fun of working in public works would be getting to paint sidewalks, because you do that, I think, for just about everything, with it, laying sewer pipe, telephone line, just because you figured out a cool tag.
And that's great, but to publicly shame people, I'm pretty sure you wouldn't want that job.
I'm not as on board with that. This is something like we're going on about a year now, I think, of water shutoffs in Detroit and threats of shutoffs. And initially, they were being much more aggressive about pursuing individual residential customers who were past due than they were about going after places like, you know, the Red Wings Stadium and all these commercial accounts that were also tens of thousands of dollars past due. It's just a mess. And the system out there, the water and sewer system in Detroit, is aging. Aging is a kind word, from what I understand. It's a perfect example of crumbling infrastructure in that costs the city lots of money, makes it really hard to accurately gauge how much water people are using across different parts of the system, and would save the city tons and tons of money over the long haul if they were able to make the initial upfront investment to fix it. And that's only one side of the problem. The other side of the problem here is that water rates have gone up by 120% in 10 years. They've more than doubled in the past decade in Detroit. And nobody in Detroit is making more money than they did 10 years ago, let alone twice as much money as they did 10 years ago.
I think now we're ready to vote. We've got three horrendous stories in front of us. We've got the McDonald's franchise that paid their workers with debit cards. We have the woman that was trying to help the child crying and hungry who got fired, and now the Detroit water story.
I'm still stuck on this Detroit water story, but I don't think Alyssa, our producer, is going to let us talk about this anymore. No, she's shaking her head. Okay, so does that mean we have to vote?
We have to vote.
Okay. So this is a tough one.
I have my vote, even though the urban policy geek in me, who is currently drinking cup of coffee out of a Detroit mug, despite this, you know, and how I feel for what's going on in Detroit and its, you know, implications for the people living there and what it says about our nation and infrastructure, I have to vote for the lunch lady that got fired. Partly, because it's obviously a horrendous story, but partly because, you know, she acknowledged that, yeah, it's against the law, but how often are laws massaged to, you know, and ignored to help wealthy people, you know, game the system, essentially? And it's like whenever there's a low-income person involved, you know, the law is more strict than ever. And that's the kind of stuff that really rubs me the wrong way. So I'm voting for number two.
It's really hard not to vote for the lunch lady one because it's so completely egregious. But I have to admit, I'm really still stuck on the public shaming by Public Works in Detroit, right? I mean, I don't understand, how could someone possibly think that by painting someone's sidewalk blue to out them for not having been able to afford their water, is that going to make them more able to pay? Is all of a sudden a blue sidewalk going to be the ticket they've been waiting for so that they can now afford their rising water? It's just ridiculous, right? So poor shaming. I'm voting for Detroit.
Yeah, I'd encourage folks to go to the site and look at Bryce's story, because she interviewed a couple of women who are facing shutoffs, who talk a lot about that dynamic and that experience. And it's really thought-provoking about what kind of a culture we create in neighborhoods and in places that are already deeply impoverished with conduct.
Is that your vote?
No.
So what is your vote?
I'm voting for the lunch lady. It's the idea, because it's like three different layers of stupid. Like, there's the Game of Thrones, we must make an example for the sake of Law and Order, we must make an example out of this lady who gave away a sandwich, which is silly and weird to me. And then there's this the sort of sub layer, the background layer, which we talked about. This stuff doesn't pay off. Trying to use the provision of food in schools, which for a lot of these kids is a really, really crucial source of steady nutrition throughout the school year. And it's summertime,
helps with
by
their
the
cognitive ability.
Right. Absolutely. All of which delivers returns to society in the future in terms of lower incarceration costs, lower public support costs, all those things. We take this very, very short-term myopic view of systems like this, and we penny pinch in these absurd ways, and I just don't get it.
Also, I mean, I'm just sort of picturing this, right? I mean, I guess the way that the lunch lady could have been in the right, in the school's opinion, would have been to adopt the Newt Gingrich school of thought and have forced the child to work for his sandwich, right? Do we need children's work requirements brought back in schools?
Are you running for office? No.
I have an announcement later in the episode.
Well, and of course, all this really is driven on some level by central and federal and state policy, right? We underfund schools, so they have to pinch pennies over crap like school lunches.
Yeah, amen.
All right, I think that's all the time we have. But Alan, as always, we can't wait to do this again with you.
Absolutely.
We'll see you in a weekly-ish.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. Earlier this month, Vanity Fair revealed its June cover featuring Caitlyn Jenner, along with the headline, "Call Me Caitlyn," blazoned on it. Immediately, this sparked a national conversation around issues impacting the transgender community. To discuss this, I'm joined by my friends and colleagues, Dr. Laura Durso, Director of CAP's LGBT Research and Communications Project, as well as Sarah McBride, research associate for the team and the first out trans woman to work in the White House. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you for having us.
So before we get into some of the issues that really were put in the spotlight because of Caitlyn's cover and the subsequent conversations, I just wanted to know, you know, what were your initial reactions to the Diane Sawyer interview, to her very public coming out process as a trans woman?
Well, I think the first thing is that when anyone comes out and decides to live a complete and authentic life, it's cause for celebration. And I think seeing Caitlyn Jenner take her life into her own hands, take her journey into her own hands, is something that we can all learn from. I think that the Diane Sawyer interview was done in a way that was incredibly compassionate, and presented Caitlyn Jenner and all transgender people in a multidimensional, complex way, and as the full humans that we are. And so I think we've seen a lot of progress in the last several years in how people and how the media are portraying transgender people. And I think that the Diane Sawyer interview and Caitlyn Jenner's coming out has really just been a pinnacle of that type of portrayal.
I agree with Sarah. I think it's been a pretty amazing conversation. I fully admit that when rumors first started to trickle out that this was Caitlyn's reality, I admit I was fully concerned that this was just going to be another example of trans people being the butt of a joke, and that this was part of a publicity around the family. And I think what's been so remarkable is to be able to see that Caitlyn was in control of her own story, was able to tell it through her family as well, and that it was actually a pretty remarkable story to share.
Yeah, and I was just struck by the amount of people in my news, in my Facebook news feed that were posting pictures celebrating her. And it, I guess this is now an overused phrase, but it seems like we really are at the trans tipping point that people might not fully know all the right phrases to use, the proper language, and are still coming to terms with what impacts the transgender community. But people realize this is cause for celebration.
I think that that's absolutely right. And a transgender author always quotes her mother and says, "You can't hate someone whose story you know." And I think that Caitlyn Jenner brings to America someone that so many people know. So many people know her story. So many people know her from her time in the Olympics, from her participation with the television show on E!, that she provides a reference point for so many people when approaching trans issues. And that's how we open hearts and minds, is by having those personal stories, is by demonstrating that transgender people are people first and foremost. And I think Caitlyn Jenner helps do that.
And you mentioned E, and one of the interesting things as part of her coming out process was there was a two-part special that was really different than some of the previous Kardashian shows because it was a lot more, I think, heartfelt. But it showed that this is a process for the family as well. You know, was there anything that you thought was surprising or familiar or just important from these specials?
Yes, and I think what's really important to acknowledge is that both the Diane Sawyer interview and the E! Specials captured the family at a moment in time in their evolution on acceptance. But I think what's so important, and regardless of what you think about the Kardashian and Jenner clan from a pop culture standpoint, what's so fundamentally important about those shows was that they all collected around Caitlyn and approached their process from a place of support and love and acceptance, showing the sometimes negative emotions that family members experience when this happens is important for the families who are watching this, who can relate to some of those emotions, some of those experiences, but in the end, see a family modeling the right behavior, which is a behavior of acceptance. And I know from me personally, watching that special on E!, seeing the family, seeing Kris Jenner and to some degree Khloe Kardashian mourn Caitlyn Jenner and what felt like Caitlyn Jenner's passing to them was reflective of my experience as a family, that sometimes families need to understand that this is a process emotionally. But at the end of the day, what the Jenners and the Kardashians, what my family learned and what so many families learn of transgender people is that while it may feel like a loss at first, at the end of the day, it's the same person. It's just a more complete, more authentic version.
And so while there's been a lot of outpouring of positive reactions to Caitlyn's coming out, there's also been a pushback on the celebration itself from both people in the trans community and outside of it. But it's mainly to the fact that people are saying that Caitlyn is a relatively privileged person. She's wealthy. She's white. She presents as a traditionally feminine person. And they say that this is distracting from some of the real issues that are prevalent in the trans community. Can you unpack what these arguments are about?
Well, first, I'll say that there's a saying that if you've met one trans person, then you've met one trans person. And so there's no perfect spokesperson. There's no perfect story that encompasses every challenge, every issue that the transgender community faces. And Caitlyn Jenner's story is but one, and it is certainly an atypical story given her privilege and her place in society. But that shouldn't stop us from celebrating the opportunity that this moment presents beyond just the fact that she's now living an authentic life. Caitlyn Jenner, as I said earlier, really provides that opportunity for folks who've never known a transgender person or have thought that they've never known a transgender person, for them to really latch on to the humanity of the issues. But as you mentioned, and as a lot of folks are mentioning, Caitlyn Jenner's privilege, her wealth, her status do shield her from a lot of issues that transgender people face, whether it's being discriminated against in the workplace, whether it's being denied shelter, whether it's being denied the basic health care that all people, including transgender people, need to live and to thrive. That's something that of course, her life doesn't necessarily encompass and that so many lives do, and that there are so many issues that Caitlyn Jenner doesn't solve. But Caitlyn Jenner and this moment in history provide a starting point or provide a pivot point for us to move our country forward on the substantive policy issues that transgender people need addressed by policymakers.
Yeah, Sarah's totally right. And I think this is why visibility is so important and why we cannot say enough about the importance of Caitlyn Jenner being willing to tell her story. Because what we are trying to learn about is what are those issues, as Sarah's mentioning, that do face, you know, the community, and what things disproportionately impact the transgender community. And so that's why visibility and research are so important, because the research that we do have really does suggest that for so many trans people, life is really difficult. So trans people, from the data that we have, are nearly four times as likely to live with $10,000 or less for the year. I mean, we're talking really just extreme levels of poverty, that they're more likely to be discriminated against in employment settings. We've got some pretty scary numbers around harassment in the workplace, nearly all of them. which is sort of where we're talking with the numbers. What I'm actually pretty impressed with is how quickly we were able to go from celebrating the cover to talking about all of these issues. We're here right now, not too long after the cover was released, being able to share with your listeners a lot of the data that we do have. And so, you know, again, can't overstate how important visibility and telling stories is, but then how tragic some of these stories truly can be.
And you all published a report earlier this year on the disproportionate impact of homelessness on trans youth by your colleague Hannah Hussey. Reports Beyond Four Walls and a Roof. It's on the AmericanProgress.org site if anyone's interested in looking at that. But the report talks about some of the causes of this disproportionate impact and some of the solutions. But why are we seeing this disproportionate impact of homelessness on trans youth, and what are the long-term implications?
Absolutely. Well, again, I will say that we need more data. We need more stories to be able to tell the full picture. We hear a lot about the disproportionate number of LGBT youth who are housing unstable, who are living on the streets. And we often don't know, you know, we're not able to break apart the L, the G, the B, and the T in that. But what data we do have really suggests that trans young people are experiencing homelessness at truly heartbreaking rates. And when they're on the streets, they are experiencing maltreatment from peers, that when they seek access to things like emergency shelter, that they can be flat out turned away, that they can be inappropriately housed with other young people seeking shelter. So if you have shelters that are segregated by gender, for example, that a young person's identity is not the thing that's taken into account when, you know, appropriately housing, making decisions about where young people are housed. And so, you know, they can be then mistreated even in those places that are offering those life-saving programs. And so it's a really, it's a bleak picture, although we certainly have great examples of resiliency and strength among young people who are creating families and communities of support for each other. And, you know, I think that that's particularly, it seems like that's, I won't say particularly, but that, can, you know, is true very much so for trans young people. The earlier that people are coming out and have really unique needs around particularly healthcare, where people need resources, they need help and education, and peers can be those people when family can't step in and do that for them. And so, you know, we in that report tried to highlight a number of these different issues that the community is facing, and a couple of different things that we think would be helpful in trying to address those. But to keep coming back to the role of family and community, that notion of acceptance is really one of the things that's going to keep young people off the streets. And so we can't stress that enough.
Yeah, and I think we'd be remiss not to mention the fact that these issues are particularly difficult for trans women of color. And I know this is something that you guys all talk about a lot in your work and in your reports. But in general, what are some of the policy proposals that we can do to address some of these issues to ensure that all trans men and women have equal protections under the law?
Well, I think your intro point is well taken, and it's something that we do need to stress, which is that all of the issues that transgender people face are exacerbated and expanded when you take into account race, class, gender, and obviously family acceptance. And the reality is that while the economic disparities for transgender people as a whole are huge, that they grow even larger when you look at Black transgender people, when you look at Latino transgender people, where those disparities jump from 15% living in extreme poverty compared to roughly 4% of the general population, to for Black transgender people, 34% live in extreme poverty compared to 9% of the non-transgender Black population. But as you also said, the reality exists, and as we talked about earlier, that transgender people and LGBT people broadly lack explicit protections from discrimination at the federal level and in a majority of states. And Congress and the states that have yet to act need to act to make sure that LGBT people, including transgender people, have the same protections from discrimination that other Americans are currently afforded.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot that we can do right now to protect young people, all young people, and LGBT young people, and trans young people in particular, within our many systems. You know, we're talking about homelessness, and, you know, there's a number of things that we can do to help young people stabilize their lives. Prevention is key, but we certainly need greater resources dedicated now to things like shelters and transitional living programs to help young people get up off the streets. We need to make sure that we're not just providing resources like the socks and the shower that you need day to day, but that we're also offering programs that empower young people, that help them with workforce development training, with educational supports. These are multidimensional young people, and I think we need to recognize that they have a lot of different needs and they have a lot of strengths that we can rely on in order to help get them up and out of shelters and their careers, as they see them, which I think is really important.
And I think just to add to this, and I think it's sort of the theme of this conversation, which is that the change that we so desperately need for transgender people in this country doesn't just come from city halls or the halls of Congress, but is about individual action. It's about individual compassion. It's about everyone, including the listeners of this show, demonstrating the love and support and compassion towards transgender people that we display towards other Americans.
Absolutely. Our guests are Sarah McBride and Laura Durso from CAP's LGBT team. Thank you guys so much for joining me, and happy Pride Month.
Happy Pride.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. We'll be back next week, Thursday at 4, also available on iTunes as a podcast, or you can listen online at weactradio.com. Special thanks to our executive producers, Alyssa Peterson and the one and only Greg Kaufman, CAP's amazing poverty and press teams.
And as always, DC's own Chris Stiles Bacon gets the last word. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And underdogs could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And it got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food, the health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom, freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?